Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Todorovic. I'm a senior lecturer of anatomy and physiology at Griffith University here in sunny Queensland, Australia. And I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Matthew Lorraine Franklin Barton. How are you, Matty?
I'm well, thank you.
And today is a special episode because we've got a special guest.
Two Matts.
Two Matts today. And our special guest, let me read you a little bit about this special guest, and I'll get him to talk about himself a little bit as well. But his name is Matt Donnelly, and he began his magic career on Adair. So we've got a magician here. Now, while working as a comedy writer for Allison Hannigan on Penn and Teller's Fool Us, Penn Jillette, I'm sure everyone knows who Penn Jillette is, challenged Matt to learn magic, and it's changed his life forever. Matt created the Mind Noodler, and now years later, Matt has toured the US and Canada in theatre and comedy clubs, performing with Piff the Magic Dragon, Matt King, and even Penn and Teller themselves. The Las Vegas Review Journal recently called him Las Vegas's brightest up-and-coming magician. Now, when he's not performing magic, he puts out two episodes a week of a lovable, insane nonsense, and this is my favorite comedy podcast, I have to admit. And Lovable Insane Nonsense actually summarizes it beautifully. It's the best comedy podcast and Ram Award winning podcast, Matt and Mattingly's Ice Cream Social. We are joined by Matt Donnelly. Welcome, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for having me on your podcast, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in. You know, I was saying to you earlier that usually our guests are medicos. They are content experts in whatever we may be talking
about.
But
are they hunks, though? I mean, are your listeners aware that you're two very good-looking gentlemen? Like, do you have like a looks bar that you have for your guests as well, or just a medical expertise?
I think right now you've set the standard. we're looking at the biggest babe we've had on Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast in a very long time.
I feel sorry for the rest of your guests.
And in saying that, maybe you are a content expert, because what we're talking about today is alcohol. So,
good.
You fit
this
that
was the
bill.
One for me.
Yeah. See, I thought alcohol and I thought Matt Donnelly. So luckily we got you in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, I've only got to visit Sydney, Australia once in my life. But boy, was I out of my depth. Can the casual Aussie can throw down
sink a few
like no other.
Oh, yeah. And I think we'll get to that point soon, because we'll be talking about some alcohol stats and we'll compare our nations. We'll have a bit of a drink off.
Good. As you know, as an American, we hate losing anything, but I think I know where this is going.
So I'd like to start the podcast by quoting somebody famous, actually, Homer.
Okay.
Not Homer who wrote the Odyssey, but Homer Simpson. And he said, to alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. And I think that summarizes it beautifully.
I don't know if truer words have ever been spoken.
I mean, you can. Yeah. I think when we think of alcohol, it is obviously the cause of a lot of pain, a lot of misery, and a lot of death, in all honesty. But it's also the reason why we have cities today and why we've been able to survive as a community in large groups is because alcohol was required in order for us to drink potable water. So it's this strange relationship we've had with alcohol. Do you think your relationship with alcohol, Matt's, been strange, or has it been a nice one?
Oh, it's been fluctuating, I guess, is really. I think in terms of now, I think I have a pretty good relationship with alcohol, for sure.
I think we all go through that, right? We go through the phase where we haven't had it for a very long time, and then we may have a little bit too much of it.
It's the first thing you test your limits with, right? It's the first thing that you, like, hey, I got away from my parents' eye, and now I can really try to figure out what this body and brain can handle. Let's test away. Let's be men of science with alcohol.
That's right. You're doing your own experiments here.
Yeah, I think that's the case for sure.
So I think, sorry, go on.
Yeah, I would say, so my personal relationship with alcohol is that, like, in high school, I don't know how you guys call schools.
High school. Yeah.
Okay, so in high school, I actually didn't drink a lot. I found that people were really weird about drinking in high school. And so I started doing comedy in high school, and I actually started doing this comedy show. I was like the first kid who wasn't 18 to get into this improv comedy show on the weekends every Friday and Saturday. And I saw that show and I was like, oh, I don't want to party at all in high school. I want to do this. And so I actually spent high school not drinking, but performing every Friday and Saturday night.
So that was your drug of choice. Weekends.
Exactly. Yeah. I traded in alcohol for attention. And, and then college, I was like, I should catch up with all my high school friends. And really spent my first semester. I remember going to this party it was a recruiting party for a fraternity. So before you try to figure out if you can get people to do dumb things to initiate their way into fraternities, you have these large parties that everyone can go to show that you're the coolest fraternity.
So we don't have frats here. Like,
you don't have frats here?
No, we don't
have. To a very minor extent. I think some universities do.
Really?
But not to the scale of America.
Oh, not even close.
Yeah, not even close. And I wouldn't bother. I skipped that whole thing as well. But I went to this party by this fraternity trying to recruit people or whatever. And so they threw this giant warehouse party and there was like thousands of people there. And then it's like I was 18 years old. It was like my first big college party. And the next few days walking around college campus, people were like, oh, you were the drunk guy from the party last night. And I was like, I was the drunk guy from the huge warehouse party. Like, I was the one who was like, oh boy. So I did not handle myself well that night. But
did you become the president of the frat house as a result?
I was just, I guess, a mess, a real mess.
So do you think the mix of alcohol and your love of performing alcohol exaggerated that?
Yes. Yeah, definitely in college. Yeah. My need for attention went way up with alcohol in my system, for sure.
I think when you get into college, we all need attention in one way or another. And alcohol is that lubricant, I suppose. And it's probably been that lubricant since time immemorial.
Yeah, my brother had a great quote about going to college. Where he just was like, you go to college, yes, find your major, find what you want to do in your life. Yeah, do that. But like, you go to college because you'd be an asshole if you enter the real world at 18.
That's so true.
You know, like, just go somewhere else to incubate your experiment with yourself. Just go anywhere else to maybe flex a little bit more, to see who you are a little bit more, and then try the real world out.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that was probably smart thinking.
No one is ready for an 18-year-old Dr. Mike. It wasn't Dr. Mike then. But
no, if I tried it. I tried to produce my own TV show and everything at 18 and failed. And if I did, I'd be one of the biggest pricks around right now. I just know it.
Yeah, imagine that, getting your own TV show as an 18-year-old.
Well, thank goodness Mike hasn't actually left university.
That's actually a good point. I've been Van Wilder for 20-odd years now.
So he hasn't been in the
world. Because you teach at a college, right?
Yeah. So we're at Griffith University in Australia. So we're in Queensland. Probably, you know, there's not a lot of universities in Queensland, probably like three or four major universities here, and we're one of those. And Matt and I both teach anatomy and physiology here. And so I basically, and probably similar to Matt, however Matt was down in Sydney, went from doing our undergraduate degree to doing a postgraduate degree to doing a PhD, teaching that whole time, and then getting a position within the university, becoming faculty.
Oh, so you just never got out.
That's right.
No.
You're there the whole time.
I'm stuck. And if I were to leave the university, I've got no transferable skills. So I don't know what I could possibly do. I need this job. I'm not going to tell my higher ups, but I need this.
Well, thank goodness, yeah.
And interestingly, Mike's from Brisbane, which we call Bris Vegas, which is...
Good point.
Oh.
The American equivalent where you're from, Matt.
Yeah. That's right. So, yeah, I mean, talk about the power of alcohol. Living in Las Vegas is that. I always say people come here not to be the worst versions of themselves, but people come here to try out being the worst versions of themselves. It's worth noting that amateur effort. It's really worth noting that, like, the really no bearings as to how this is actually going to work or fly. It's really important to understand people's behavior when they come to Las Vegas.
We've got the Gold Coast, which is probably a diluted version of Las Vegas.
Yes. Yeah. Only because we have a casino named after the Gold Coast. I've heard of the Gold Coast.
Oh, there you go. I didn't realize that. Perfect. So I think... Let's get started with what alcohol actually is. So we've spoken about alcohol colloquially as what's been in that drink, you know, whether it be right. Beer, wine, spirits, whatever it may be. But alcohol has actually, there's a couple of different types of alcohol. There's isopropyl alcohol, there's methanol, there's ethanol. And the one that we drink, well, hopefully that people are drinking, is the ethanol. Methanol is toxic in small doses, so it only takes 2 or 3 teaspoons to actually have some pretty nasty effects for you with methanol.
Then you're blind.
It will make you blind, but literally. Just by the way that it gets you blind physiologically and metaphorically. And isopropyl alcohol takes a little bit more to really knock you down, but still toxic. I mean, everything's toxic. It's all
is
just
that
about
the
doses.
Common ingredient in all the hand sanitizers we've been using for the last 14 months?
Yeah, isopropyl alcohol. And what you'll probably find, I don't know if you found this over there, Maddie, obviously you've got, you know, everyone's got the hand pumps of disinfectant everywhere. Have you had any that smells a bit like rum?
Yes, actually. We bought one from this like company that was like, they do like a really great thing of putting like the less fortunate people to work or people with certain disabilities and that kind of stuff, and physical disabilities to work. And there was right at the top of the pandemic decided they would sell big jugs of hand sanitizer that you could buy. And we had it at our recording studio, the Churn in Las Vegas. And it drives Paul crazy because when anyone uses it, it smells like a bad like pina colada or something.
It does. That's exactly what it smells like.
What? This stinks. So yeah, I'm familiar.
I've got one right outside my office and I hate it as well because when students walk past and use it, it just wafts into my office. But it's, yeah, because when alcohol is fermented and produced, you've got a whole bunch of byproducts, and you can take methanol as a byproduct, ethanol, isopropyl alcohol. And so these can be obviously distributed and used in various different ways. Ethanol is obviously the one that we're going to drink, isopropyl, cleaning our hands, and methanol is also used as a solvent to be able to wash things away. So they've all got different uses, but today we're going to really focus on ethanol itself, because when we ingest ethanol, if the listeners, and I'll probably say statistically, many of the listeners have had alcohol. I mean, statistically, 40% of Australians over 14 have one standard drink per week. So that's quite a bit, especially over the age of 14. Drinking legal age here is 18, 21 over there, right, Matt?
Yeah, 21 over here. Yeah.
So
you can fight and kill for the country at 18, but don't get drunk till you're 21.
Never thought of it like that. I think we can join the army at 18. I think we can join younger.
Maybe
16.
Earlier, yeah.
Yeah. So when we look at alcohol, when it's ingested, it obviously has a whole range of psychoactive effects. So these effects can be, you know, happiness, euphoria, sedation, anesthesia. It can be pro-anxiety or anti-anxiety, depending on the timing of it and depending on the individual. And so it's probably one of the reasons why we ingested it. And for millions of years, we've seen animals ingesting fruit that have fallen from the trees and have fermented on the floor. And we see them in that sedated, euphoric kind of state. And so that's probably where it began, where we just saw an animal eating an old rotting bit of guava on the ground, and then we decided to give it a go, and then we thought, let's make
this. I want to feel like that.
Yes.
I want to feel like that drooling saber-toothed tiger over there. How do I do that?
And we haven't stopped.
There was actually a situation, I think, in 2017 where a whole lot of birds in LA were just smashing into buildings and gates and fences and so forth. And they, you know, like hundreds of them. And they did an autopsy on a few of them and found that they were completely blind, drunk, with overripe berries. And so when they did like a liver analysis, they found that it was like one part per thousand ethanol in their liver.
So they were proper pissed.
Yeah, and they couldn't fly straight.
And that's when LA launched that Uber for Birds program, right? Where you could don't fly home. If you're eating berries, don't fly home alone.
Never took off the ground.
Use Uber.
It was a good campaign. So I think alcohol isn't – so ethanol isn't just necessarily used as a drink, or at least within drinks. It's also used as an antiseptic itself, as an antidote. So it's sometimes used as an antidote to methanol poisoning, and is used as a medicinal solvent. So it means it dissolves a whole bunch of stuff, which is great. It's used for as a combustible fuel. So ethanol is used for a whole bunch of things. Antiseptic, yeah. So we're predominantly going to focus on its use within drinking, because obviously that's relatively ubiquitous, its use within alcohol, or as in alcohol to drink.
And the name of alcohol itself is an Arabic term. Al means the. Kohl is a paint, in which you would have seen Cleopatra use on her eyes. So that's like a eye shadow paint. And that in Arabic is called kohl. But the way that they extract that from the stone is they need to use alcohol. And so it became associated with that actually word. So alcohol, as the name itself, was first used in the 16th century in conjunction with the eyeliner.
So what was it called before that?
Oh, it probably just named according to its drink, so like beer or wine or ale or... But as a chemical name,
yeah,
it wasn't termed alcohol until, I guess, from
For me personally, I've never worn eyeshadow unless I've consumed alcohol, so it's good to know that it's paying proper tribute to Cleopatra.
We'll update Wikipedia with that.
Yeah, we'll update your IMDb with that one.
Thank you.
So I think when we look at alcohol throughout history, like we've said, it's been drunk for many, many years. And it's not just for that, the effects that it may have neurologically or even psychologically, but also because it was one of the only ways we could ingest potable water. So you'd have big communities, large groups of people living together, and it was very difficult to have water that wasn't contaminated by bacteria or some sort of pathogen that may get you sick or even kill you. Now, we didn't know back then about pathogens, but we knew that if we drank from a particular water source, we'd get quite sick. But when you start to ferment, and we'll talk about this process in a sec, where you can take sugars and you take a certain type of bacteria or yeast, they will produce as a byproduct ethanol. And that ethanol is actually antimicrobial. And so it's really good at killing off other bacteria, and you don't even need a lot of it to kill it off. So a lot of the drinks, hundreds, thousands of years ago within large communities, were alcoholic to some degree. Even the kids, even, you know, 7, 8, 9-year-olds were drinking alcohol. But this sort of probably ale that they were drinking was probably only between probably like a mid-strength beer.
Probably not in that.
Probably a little bit less than mid-strength.
So if you're one of the 60% of Australians 15 and under who still haven't drank, you know, you want to start slow is what you're saying. You start with small amounts is what you're saying.
And that's your excuse. You're just saying, there's no potable water in the environment. I need something.
I'm worried about microbes, Dad.
Yeah, that's right. There's a little Louis Pasteur just growing. So that's one of the reasons why. And so that's the, you know, the history of alcohol and why it's sort of come to be. But now, as we know, there's many different types of alcoholic beverages that are out there. And you've worked as a bartender before, Matt. So you'd be aware of many different types of alcohols.
For sure.
So I think Matt's got a little quiz for you where so we're going to talk about the process of producing alcohol, but...
So one quick step is alcohol or ethanol itself is produced through a fermentation process, which usually needs a sugar. And then in conjunction with yeast, which is the microorganism, it has to be kind of without air. So usually it's fermenting or producing its energy with this type of sugar, but it's inside a liquid, so it hasn't got exposure to air. And as a byproduct, it produces the ethanol. So for humans, when we produce our energy, we have hopefully oxygen to make our ATP. But for these guys, they're without alcohol. Now, occasionally for humans, we may be in a situation where we need to produce energy without or very minimal air, you know, when we exercise. But our byproduct of fermentation is we produce lactate, or it used to be called lactic acid, but I think that's incorrect now, right?
Yeah, there's no evidence.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's no evidence that lactic acid actually exists. We've just been using that to, because when you... So the term acid means it releases a hydrogen ion, and that's what make that's what's the damaging component of acids. But there's always been the assumption that there's been some chemical that releases these hydrogen ions that gives you that muscle soreness and muscle pain. But we've never actually been able to measure that product before, or that lactic acid. So what we now think is that hydrogen is produced through exercise, through some process, and then this other thing comes in called lactate, which tries to neutralize it. So everyone says, oh, lactic acid is, you know, the burn, and that's the reason why you get muscle soreness after exercise. But in actual fact, it's probably the fact that what's being produced is there to neutralize all the hydrogen that's being made. So it's stopping you from being in pain. So it doesn't cause it. It's probably there to buffer it out, make you feel a little bit better.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
So therefore, when we exercise and we start to run low in oxygen, we produce lactate. But if we were yeast, we would be producing ethanol, and as we are running, we would be getting drunk.
Mm.
Which,
so if we were bacteria, every time we do a 100-meter sprint, we'd be pissed by the end of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm for this.
The only time in your life you've wanted to be a bacteria.
Because that's the thing, if you want me to be a little, if my wife wants me to ease up, I can just make, and I will stop exercising. I will chill out.
So basically for this yeast, actually I think bacteria, when they ferment, they produce acetic acid, which is more like vinegar.
Yeah.
Whereas yeast produces the ethanol. So Matt, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to give you a whole list of different alcoholic beverages. And I want you to give me what you think the base product is. So this is the where the sugar comes from, what plant source or fruit source this particular drink gets its energy from.
Okay.
Okay, so when you hear beer, what is that? Where?
Yeah.
What's the basis of that?
Wheat, hops, barley.
Yeah, malted grains. So this is kind of like activated grains and then dried out. And then they're put into the fluid. And I think hops just gives its flavor rather than the fermentation part, but I could be wrong with that.
Okay.
So with hops, so here's an interesting side point. You've heard of Indian Pale Ale, right, Matt?
Absolutely, yeah.
So IPA. So the reason why IPA came about was back when the British were, you know...
Trading with
India. That's probably heavily. A nice way of putting it. It was a six-month journey going from England to India, and India was too hot to brew beer. So they're trying to figure out ways to get alcohol from England to India. And what one bloke realized is that if you put a lot of hops in it, it takes a long time for that fermentation process to occur, and the alcohol doesn't, the beer doesn't go off. It doesn't, 6 months is actually a good fermentation time. So Indian Pale Ale came about so that they actually had beer by the time they got to their destination being India. And it was actually, they realized this actually tastes quite good. The fermentation process, 6 months, kept the beer, didn't go off, and it tasted even better. And that's where IPA comes from.
I'll also tell you a fun fact about IPAs. When I was trying to get into bars underage and didn't want to get carded, my way of throwing the bartender off my scent was asking for if they had any kind of selections of IPAs. And that was my way of looking like a more sophisticated person.
How could under 21s know of an IPA? Oh, you must be over 21. You could say three letters. I like that though. I like that though, because that's sort of that's a 18-year-old psychology, isn't it?
Totally. I'm going to sound like an adult.
That's right.
All right, a few more. Bourbon.
All right, let's do it.
Bourbon.
Bourbon. That is corn, at least 50% corn. And then
very good.
It could be a couple of other things. It could be like a small percentage of rye and and other things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. Right. So I think they call it a mash, which I guess is just a mixture. But yeah, it has to be at least 50% corn. And it's flavored through the oak barrel, which apparently has to sit in for at least 2 years. Next one, gin.
Oh, that's a trickier one. I believe juniper berries, right?
That gives its flavor, but it's still okay. The basis of it must come from the grains, which is actually distilled. So now it moves on beyond just a fermentation process. Because interestingly, a natural fermentation process, the yeast can only go to a percentage of 13% and then they'll start dying off themselves. And so natural fermentation...
Oh, because it's antimicrobial.
Yeah, so it only gets to a percentage and then everything will die in it and it will stop being any more... The strength will stop.
So the distillation makes it more alcoholic. That's
right. So then we humans learnt the process of distillation, which is the separation of all the other ingredients, I guess. And that's where it becomes stronger.
Mm. That whoever figured that out, we should be studying them in school as well.
All right, next one is sake.
Sake.
Sake?
Yeah.
Oh, sake. I know that it's a type of wine, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it comes from rice.
Yeah. It's rice wine. Right.
Rice wine. Okay,
that's
two more. Whiskey.
That's wheat and wheat again, right?
Yeah, it's a mash, but I think, wheat, possibly barley. What's the difference between whiskey and scotch?
Scotch is from Scotland.
Is there anything they do specific to make it scotch, though?
The type of barrels they age it in. Okay. I believe give it its taste, and they go for the kind of can have like a peat mossy quality to it, or like a sharp taste to it. But yeah, they like to get specific tastes out of their barrels, I believe.
Okay, and then finally vodka,
potatoes.
Yeah, it's still a mash, but a lot more potatoes are in it. Yeah, well done, you nailed it.
You did. Good job.
Do my best as a bartender to know some of these things.
Well, you've held up.
I also am a sucker for going to like tastings and tours and stuff.
I used to do that a lot. Yeah. I used to go on whiskey tastings as often as I could until my esophagus decided it could no longer handle it. So I actually don't drink anymore. Well, I shouldn't say unfortunately. It's probably most beneficial to my health. But
And all of us.
And and everyone around me. So I think let's talk about, so you're talking about the distillation process. So it's probably a good point to bring up what is distilled out.
Yeah.
Right. So have you heard of the term congener, Matt? Congeners?
No. I dated a congener once, but I don't know the scientific term.
That's got to have been in Jersey.
Yeah. She drove an IROC Z, no sleeves. We went bowling.
So a congener in this sense is a byproduct of the fermentation process and probably something that you want to try and get out within the distillation. So that includes things like methanol, acetaldehyde, acetone, just chemical components. Some may be fine to keep, some probably not so much. And methanol is probably one of the big ones you want to try and get rid of because if you don't, again, like I said, 2 to 3 teaspoons of methanol will be quite toxic to you. And this is super important, obviously, because when people brew their own alcohol or create moonshine, for example, they probably don't distill things very well. And this is one of the reasons why.
Is moonshine distilled or is it just naturally? I guess it has to be because it's pretty strong, right?
I've never done it. But if they don't distill it properly.
You call it something else.
If they don't distill it properly, the methanol level can be too high.
Right.
And so.
Well, also, you bring up a good thing about it being confusing, right? There are people who are desperate who, will try to drink hand sanitizer or drink things with an alcohol content because alcohol is one big word under that umbrella. And so people really mess themselves up. And I knew that I shouldn't drink hand sanitizer, but that's it. I didn't know why until right now. There I just believed the person. I took them at their word up until this moment.
Well, thankfully you didn't do the experiment yourself because it's probably not something you want to ingest. So if somebody, so it's not the methanol itself. Methanol can actually be excreted, no problem. But it's what our body metabolizes methanol into. And so that's formaldehyde. And it's the formaldehyde
which we use to preserve tissue, like bodies, our cadavers are preserved in formaldehyde.
Yeah, exactly right.
So you don't want that in your body.
Not in high quantity. Mm. I mean, you get formaldehyde from eating an apple, for example. So, in that quantity, it's all good. But if you have higher quantities, which you'll get from methanol metabolism, bad.
That explains why when I eat an apple, I feel dead inside.
That's how I feel for most fruit, unfortunately. And so the formaldehyde will turn into formic acid, and formic acid is what ants produce. Have you ever squished an ant and smelt a dead ant before?
I've squished or burned with a magnifying glass. Never went to the smelling portion.
Oh, okay. That could have just been my
upbringing.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do. But the smell that you get when you squish an ant, that's formic acid. Yeah. And that's the end product, one of the end products of methanol metabolism.
So what is this ant doing then?
Well, I don't know why
drunk ants... on methanol.
Actually, that's a good question. I should have figured out why ants have a lot of formic acid. I thought it was part of their process, because they can sting, right? And they've got pincers.
And they can see as well, so obviously they're not blind.
A good point.
Man, if ants are drunk, I'd hate to see them sober. Look how regimented they are when they're drunk. That's crazy.
That's very true. But they all do just follow each other, don't they? So
that's true.
It's just the one at the front that needs to be sober. That's the designated driver back to the ant nest. So they just got to follow him. So when you turn... Or when the body, God forbid, don't drink methanol. But if methanol is going to turn into formaldehyde. And the process of this requires an enzyme that our liver produces. Actually, a lot of tissues produce, but the liver produces it the most. And this is alcohol dehydrogenase. That's the enzyme. Turns methanol into formaldehyde. Now, interestingly, when you metabolize ethanol, it turns into acetaldehyde. So methanol, formaldehyde, ethanol, acetaldehyde, and it also uses the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase. So the same enzyme. And this is the whole reason why when somebody has a methanol poisoning, they may give somebody ethanol, because it will competitively inhibit the use of the enzyme because it's using it all to itself. And so what ends up happening is the methanol doesn't get converted to the nasty formaldehyde, stays as methanol, and the kidneys allow you to pee it out. So that's how that works.
Can I add something there? There's a hypothesis here on terms of origin of why we as humans may like to consume alcohol, and it's called the drunken monkey hypothesis.
Have you heard of that?
No, but I'm all ears.
So it was proposed by Robert Dudley. So what he thought was our early ancestors, we're talking 10 million years ago, when we came out of the trees and started to walk on land, maybe had a propensity to want to consume, not seek it, but have the ability to process alcohol in fermented fruits. So he looked at berries, I think it was from the palm fruit, and found if the berry's in the tree, it has basically, and it's unripe, it has no ethanol. And then as it becomes ripe, super ripe, and then once it's on the ground, when it's on the ground, it's got 4.5% alcohol on it. And so
wow,
the primates that he looked at didn't really like to eat the ones on the ground. It preferred the unripe / ripe ones. But they also found that in our ancestors through the fossil record, we found that there's a gene that codes for the ADH, which
is alcohol dehydrogenase,
and found that it was seems to be 40 times more what's overexpressed in our early ancestors when we started to move on to land. And we found in humans it's this particular enzyme is located in the mouth, in the esophagus, and in the stomach. So he proposed that, if it's in those locations, it must mean that we were eating overripe fruit on the ground, because we were now on the ground, not up in the trees.
And is that to get pissed?
No, that's just probably if you had a whole lot of, fermenting apples, and this was your only source of eating food, you would want to have an advantage of you can still eat it without getting sick, and or process the alcohol without getting super drunk, but also process the alcohol into energy.
Yeah, so that's a good point, because ethanol has a lot of calories. So about about 7 calories per gram, which is like the same as fat, basically.
So there is. That's great. I mean, I remember reading Harari's Sapiens book, right? Mm-hmm. They talked about like tens of thousands of years ago, humans are very likely scavengers. And that's why we have a propensity for like marrow and drinking marrow and that kind of thing, because we would go last from the big, predators were much bigger than us, and we'd wait for them to eat what they're eating. Then we'd come around and get what's left or whatever. That would kind of fit in that profile as well. Like yeah. get yeah. the fruit that's sitting there on the ground.
That's it.
From the other people who are more competitive for that tree fruit. Interesting.
Yeah, and if you actually look at Mike's diet, it looks he looks like a scavenger. It's something you could have a dumpster, really.
Yeah, I, definitely dumpster. What was the first word you used?
Yeah.
Scavenger.
Yeah. Scavenger, dumpster. It's they've all been... they're all adjectives I've had used to describe exactly how I eat. So that's okay. My wife would agree. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. So I think we should talk about absorption. When we drink alcohol, we absorb very small amounts in our mouth, but we actually absorb like 20% of that alcohol in our stomach. We don't really absorb anything else in our stomach. So aspirin, maybe some other medications, but no other foods. We don't absorb like proteins, fats, carbohydrates, or anything like that in our stomach. All that's absorbed in our intestines. But alcohol, 20% of it is.
Can I just ask a question here?
Yeah.
Remember we used to have, in mouthwash,
yeah.
we used to have alcohol in it?
Yeah.
And then they got rid of it because of oral cancers? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that because the alcohol was being processed into acetaldehyde?
Yeah.
So, and that's a carcinogen?
Yeah.
So that would then indicate that it is being metabolized in the mouth.
Yeah, but very small amounts. Yeah. So the pretty most tissues will have the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase to metabolize it. But obviously most of it's produced in the liver. Because obviously everything... So everything that we obviously take in or ingest orally gets absorbed from our intestines into the bloodstream, and immediately it goes from the blood to the liver. So everything sort of but fats go basically from straight from the blood to the liver once we've absorbed it. And that includes alcohol. So it goes from the stomach, 20% absorption, then the small intestines, probably around about that 80% absorption. So pretty much the rest of it. But as we get down, some alcohol is not going to be absorbed. And by the time we get to the large intestines towards the end, that's where all of our bacteria are, and that alcohol can damage the bacteria. So it can change your gut biota, it could change what they produce, can cause some inflammation. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on, but can also just affect that gut microbiota. So
sounds super healthy.
Yeah, and I think the final point we'll get to with this podcast is definitely. I mean, we know that there is not one, there's not an amount of alcohol that's safe to ingest. We've always thought
so
that.
So the whole glass of wine a day, you're okay.
Keeps the doctor away.
That stuff is all kind of colloquial and just pro-business kind of thing.
That's right. Exactly. There's not one safe bit of alcohol to ingest. And that came out in a Lancet 2018.
Yeah, it's fairly recent.
Meta-analysis. Well done. It took millions of people. It reviewed so much data.
Who did that study?
The Lancet.
Well, from my cold, dead hands, Lancet.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change many people's minds. And I hope people realize that the
point... I don't think anyone hears that alcohol is bad for you is like, what?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
No way.
I did an Instagram live with a couple of medicos a couple of days ago. And we were talking about the roles of the liver, what the liver does. And we spoke about alcohol. And a couple of people were getting up in arms about the fact that we're saying that alcohol isn't good for you. And they're saying, but there's benefits. And I just want to highlight in this podcast that we're not making any moral judgments here whatsoever. We're just talking about the biology. We're talking about the health effects of alcohol. And we know that there are no health benefits to alcohol.
So you got a medical condition where you were told you couldn't drink anymore. You shouldn't drink anymore.
Yeah.
Specifically for your deal.
Yep.
Did you miss it? Or yeah. At what point did you stop missing it?
I did. I do. I will have a beer every now and then. I might have a beer maybe one beer once a week, once every 2 weeks. But I don't metabolize it very well. So it's not just my esophagus. So here's my deal. I'll tell you what my deal is. For about 5 years, I have been feeling crook after most meals that I've been eating, right? And I had... what's called, Matt's heard this, so this is why he's laughing. I don't shut up about it. Gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, or GORD in Australia, because esophagus starts with an O over here. No idea why.
I'm with you on that. Australia, I'm with you.
Oh, good.
I wish we could join you. If a petition comes up in America, I will sign it. I like it. It should be an O word. I'm with you.
GORD. GORD sounds right. So yeah, I at least had GORD for many years, and I would take what we call a PPI, so a proton pump inhibitor. It stops the acid because the biggest issue with reflux is that the acid starts to erode the esophagus and there's no protective mechanism there like there is in the stomach. So you stop the production of acid, no damage to the esophagus. I've been on PPIs for 3 and a bit years. And, you know, when a doctor doesn't know what the cause is for a disease, they use a nice fancy word called idiopathic. So I had idiopathic GORD, meaning we don't know what's causing it.
Was the doctor's, that's a disease or the patient?
As in
idiopathic.
Yeah, he said, you're an idiot and it's idiopathic. And I thought, fair.
You have idiot dumpsters disease.
Idiot dumpsters disease. Get out of my office.
And stop eating out of the bin.
You make me sick. Jesus. Right, that'll be $200. So I got a colonoscopy, and this was recently. This was like a month ago. I got a colonoscopy, and they took a couple of biopsies of my intestines, and the intestines produce the enzymes that break down proteins, fats, and carbs, right? So I had a look at those enzymes, and I realized that I am not just lactase deficient, so I can't break down the sugar in milk. That's like 2/3 of the population. Not an issue. But I'm sucrase deficient. I can't break down table sugar. I can't break down everyday sugar. So,
oh wow.
Any time over the past 5, 6, 7 years, maybe 10 years close to, any time I eat chocolate, cakes, lollies, sweets, I feel like vomiting. I get proper crook. And
wow.
And so, but the biggest,
what have you been eating?
Just like Whole Foods. I eat too well. That's the problem. And I know that sounds silly, but there's times where I feel
basically those enzymes had no use when you changed your diet to a more healthy thing and they kind of started dying off. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So if I eat really carbohydrate dense foods, that breaks down into sucrose and I need the enzyme sucrase to do it. So even if I eat a lot of potato chips or anything like that.
Maybe you should just colonize yourself with yeast and you can just produce
ethanol.
Yeah,
vodka. So just get them to do it. Hijack their ability to do it. So anyway, long story short, can't digest sugars basically. So that's a lot of fun.
I'm curious about this because I will basically have a bourbon on the rocks. It's basically like I'll have that like once a week or twice a week is kind of my drink. I used to be able to drink like 6 Guinness at a time. I used to be able to drink back or that or 6 pack of beer, no problem. Now there's no way I can drink more than 2 beers.
I'm the same.
If I have a second beer, I'm literally just like done. I cannot put anything else into my system. I am just done, and I never knew why or even talked about it.
And I think part of that has to do with so when we age, and I'm sorry to say this, Maddie, but we're aging.
How dare you? How dare you?
we have this so our tolerance for things just tend to go down. It's like a glass of water, right? So the older you get, the more full that glass gets, and then it doesn't take much for it to spill over. And that's for many different things. It's called our physiological reserve. So our physiological reserve diminishes. And for me and you, by the sounds of it, that includes alcohol. I can't have more than 2 beers either, otherwise I'm done in. 1 beer, feel good. 2 beers, nope. You're out.
Yeah.
You've got to tap out. And so ethanol is – and the other thing is that alcohol is something that people it's like a working muscle. In the more alcohol you have, the better you are at metabolizing it. Doesn't mean you're going to be
bodybuilders
healthier doing that, but the better you are at metabolizing it. So the enzyme, alcohol dehydrogenase, you can change the levels of through drinking. So it's not just set at a level. So the more you drink, the higher your liver expresses alcohol dehydrogenase. But it's not necessarily that's the issue. The ethanol directly can lead to inflammation of the stomach, and that's called gastritis, inflammation of the intestines. That can be colitis and damaging the gut flora and so forth. So look, it's a godsend probably, the fact that you and I can't drink more than 2 drinks at a time because...
My children think so. My children are happy when I drink less.
See, exactly. My wife's happy when I drink less too. So it's, you know, I got to see it as a godsend. But anyway, that was a hell of a digression.
Sure was. I usually do that.
Yeah, I know that's true. Now,
I think that's why we're just. I think we're in the realm of fascination of alcohol. In the
that's
body,
true,
I think, right? I think we're under the umbrella.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right. So, metabolizing it, we turn ethanol into acetaldehyde, and then we turn acetaldehyde into acetyl-CoA, and acetyl-CoA.
And this is all in the liver?
This is all in the liver. It can happen in other tissues, but primarily happens in the liver. Because like I said, 20% absorbed from the stomach into the blood, 80% from the intestines in the blood. All of that goes to the liver. The liver goes, goody, goody, goody. I'm going to turn the ethanol into acetaldehyde, and then from there into acetyl-CoA. Now, these might sound like just, you know, these strange molecular terms, but in biology, acetyl-CoA is a really important building block to make energy. And so anytime you use glucose or sugar for energy, acetyl-CoA. Fats, fatty acids, acetyl-CoA. It's sort of like all roads lead to Rome in a way with acetyl-CoA.
Okay.
Even ketones.
Is there a way to like encourage that aspect of your liver or just hope it's there?
It will be there. Acetyl-CoA is a requirement for life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I think there is a drug that they do prescribe to alcoholics to discourage them from drinking. Colloquially, they call it anti-booze, and it blocks that enzyme. So the alcohol or the ethanol stays as acetaldehyde, yep. Which is the part that gives you the kind of hangover effects. So a person who drinks alcohol can't metabolize the ethanol into the energy and just feels perpetually like they're in a hangover.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, so you need two enzymes to produce ethanol goes to acetaldehyde goes to acetyl-CoA, and then acetyl-CoA ultimately turns into carbon dioxide and water. And so what your liver does really well is turns alcohol into carbon dioxide and water. And we know that we breathe out carbon dioxide and we utilize water, you know, we're 65% water. Now, you need two enzymes to do this process. We spoke about the first one, which is alcohol dehydrogenase. Then you need another one called acetaldehyde dehydrogenase. And there is, I think it's around about 40% of the Asian population. So this is including Chinese, Japanese, Korean. They have a different type of that enzyme and they can't metabolize it very well. And so what they're, and I'm talking about the acetaldehyde enzyme, dehydrogenase enzyme. So what this means is they can turn ethanol into acetaldehyde, but they can't turn it into that nice acetyl-CoA that we ultimately want. And what they end up getting is obviously exactly what you said.
That drug.
Is the sickening effects of alcohol. It makes you flushed, makes you hot, you know, you look red, you feel like vomiting, it gives you that nasty hangover. And so this is one of the reasons why a percentage of the Asian population can't handle alcohol because of that enzyme.
So they don't necessarily get drunker, they just feel worse for it.
That's right.
They just feel worse, so they're not into it, which is like why they probably don't drink. Pride themselves on it like we pride ourselves on it.
So drinking is
I blame the Brits for that.
100%.
It's because they were drinking ale as four-year-olds, see?
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
As an American, I can tell you I have no problem also blaming the British. So we're good. We're good there. Now, do you guys have the like keto craze over there like we have here?
Yeah, absolutely. And keto, like ketones are produced from acetyl-CoA. You just snap a couple.
That's what I was curious about. Yeah. That's what I was curious about. It's like basically it's the first diet to be like, and here's what you're drinking. Because every other diet was like, you know, chill out with the drinking. And it was the first diet to come along like, okay, we know you want to drink. You're going to eat meat and you're going to drink alcohol.
So
and you're
so,
like, all right.
All right. So this this is the...
Okay. Thin days, here I come.
Dumpster time. So we when you look at ketones, right? So our brain only wants to use glucose for energy. And so glucose is the most simplest sugar that we use. We break glucose into ultimately acetyl-CoA, and then acetyl-CoA jumps into this little cycle to produce a whole bunch of energy. Now, what happens here is when you starve yourself of glucose or sugar, which keto proponents will do, they don't eat carbs, right?
No carbs.
Don't eat carbs or sugar.
Right.
The brain, which only wants sugar, says, I need some sugar. What the hell's going on? And it tries to find as many ways as possible to produce sugar from what you're already storing in the body. So mainly fats.
Like Cleopatra needs eyeshadow.
Correct.
Exactly right. The same
way. Exactly what I was thinking. But the liver does this, right?
The liver does this. Yeah. So the liver has stores of fat, and obviously adipose tissue of the body has stores of fat, for example. And it will try and take fatty acids and throw it into that cycle to try and reverse engineer glucose so the brain can use it for energy. But the problem here is that the cycle backs up. And you start to produce all this acetyl-CoA. And the acetyl-CoA can't go backwards into this glucose. And it's going, what can I do? I am going to click myself together and produce a new product called ketone bodies. This is acetyl.
It's like four of those, right?
Yeah, that's right. So beta-hydroxybutyrate and acetone are the two primary ketone bodies that are produced. They can travel to the brain and then turn back into glucose for energy, and the brain goes, great. So all ketogenesis is a roundabout way to produce more glucose, and the whole point of what they're doing is to try and limit glucose. So it's what it's doing is breaking fats down to produce that glucose, hence why they use it
makes fat the fuel for sugar. Okay.
Exactly right.
And acetone is like nail polish remover.
Yeah.
Which you may know, Matt, from your nail painting. Yeah. But also this is possibly why, and this same process occurs for diabetics, particularly type 1 diabetics, when they don't have any insulin. And one of the symptoms of a diabetic going into a ketogenesis or ketoacidosis state is their breath smells like either rotting fruit or acetone. And that's because of all this ketone. And interestingly, the ketones will be blown out through your breath, and it could give a negative reading on the blood alcohol. What do they call it?
Positive reading.
A positive reading of the...
On the breathalyzer.
Breathalyzer.
Yeah, so...
So in America, do you have a breathalyzer for...
Yes.
Yeah.
So with how come every time I watch Cops, every time I watch Cops, they make them walk the line? Is that just so they can laugh?
There's both, we have metric and imperial measurements. We like to do weird things here. So we have field sobriety tests because it's like, I'm a cop, I can do my job, I can see it.
Gotcha.
I can see it from a mile away. It's like Moneyball versus the guys who like old baseball, right? There's the guys who just know a good pitcher when they see one, and they're guys that just know how to do things X's and O's. We always like to have both, you know, the eye of the person in charge and actual statistics. So you can say no. You can refuse a breathalyzer and then try to pass a field sobriety test.
Can you refuse the walk in the line?
You tend to basically not be able to refuse both.
Okay. That's when you get taken in.
Yeah, it's when you get taken in. And what you can do is refuse the breathalyzer, walk the line knowing you might not walk it that well, but it's going to take a while for them to arrest you, book you, take you down to the station,
and force you
to have a breathalyzer. So you're hoping time is on your side between the time you get taken down to whatever.
And even though you're saying this, you don't condone anybody doing this, obviously.
Drink
driving is not something we condone.
In the game of avoiding a DUI,
yes,
that's how the game is played.
Yes, that's how others play the game.
I'm just talking about the sport.
So I think... So with that point, because obviously alcohol, when you take alcohol, you produce acetyl-CoA, which can be turned into ketones. It's basically what Matt's highlighting is that diabetics who have sugar in their body, but the cells of their body can't access the sugar because insulin is the key to open the doors of the cells for sugar to come in for it to be used. The brain thinks there is no sugar. And so the brain starts to break down the fats to produce the ketones. This is what happens.
The
liver breaks down the fats to produce the ketones. And because ketones are made of acetyl-CoA, and acetyl-CoA is what's being breathed out on a breathalyzer, it has the same chemical substrate. And that's why it gives the false positive reading for some diabetics who aren't managing their diabetes through insulin. So they may... And the thing is this, you get them out to do the field sobriety test... A diabetic who's not managing through insulin may look drunk, right? So they will be wobbly. They won't be too conscious, and their breath will smell like somebody who's drunk alcohol, particularly on the breathalyzer. So that's quite and I don't think in the game
of... It's a tough day for a diabetic.
It is a tough day. And I don't think that in the game of drink driving, like you were talking about before, hypothetically, that you could use... the excuse that I'm just a diabetic who hasn't managed my insulin.
Yeah, I feel like either way they want you off the road in that scenario.
Agreed.
Right? Like, I feel like they're I feel like you're talking about two different things, but the cop's still talking about the same thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
we that just guy don't want shouldn't people. Be driving.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Or you could say you've just been doing your nails.
That's true. But it doesn't... Yeah. Oh, I suppose that's why you're not driving very well, you know? Painting
Sorry,
your nails.
I've been trying to lick nail polish off of my...
Yeah, you quickly scull the bottle just before you open the window to do the test. Probably not the smartest thing to do. Now, what is... So in Australia, the blood alcohol limit is 0.05%. So what is it in Vegas?
0.08.
Okay. Okay, so 0.08 would be close to three standard drinks, a little bit under three standard drinks. Is that right?
Yeah, it's under three is basically the kind of thing. And then basically it used to be 1.10.
Yep.
And then...
it used to be 1.0.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then they went down to 0.08 to lower it and to basically... there's no federal guidelines, but in order to... basically, the federal government bribes states to all go to the same level to get a bunch of funding for their roads and things like that. And that's how
all the states are 0.08.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All the states are basically 0.08. Yeah.
So when we in that case, when we think about how much alcohol or ethanol or pure ethanol is within a standard drink, it's about 10 grams of pure ethanol in one standard drink. So that's like a So in Australia, we call a can a stubby.
No, I think a stubby is a little.
Oh, sorry, stubby's the bottle, right? Yeah. And then we got a tinny is the can. My bad.
Okay.
Which is about 385 mils.
It's also a small boat.
Tinny and stubby is a cop drama here in the States. So, but you call those beers? Okay,
they're also very shorts. Stubbies,
yeah. So in Australia, what you'll find is that elderly gentlemen, for some reason, wear shorts that barely hide their genitalia. And so they're called stubbies. They're very short shorts. And they're usually blue in color and they're sun damaged, right?
I think also tradies wear them. Do you call them tradies, like tradespersons in America? Tradies? Call them tradies?
No.
I think in Australia, we shorten everything.
Yeah, we ruin everything, don't we?
Add O's to it.
So, okay, so with our drinks, we've got, okay, so you got the tinny, which is the can, about 385 mils. You got a stubby, which is, I can't even think, well, about 600 mils, probably a bit under.
Stubby?
Yeah.
No, it's like 200 and something mils.
Is it less than a tinny?
Yeah, I think it's pretty small.
Okay. And then if you go to the pub, you can ask for a pot, a schooner, or a pint. And so a pot's the smallest, which is about a tinny.
Okay.
A schooner is probably a little bit more than a stubby.
I think it's like 600 mils.
And then a pint is like two beers.
Okay.
Yeah. But you guys have pints, right?
We have pints and then people are like, sometimes you Jugs. At the bar, they're like, just give me half a beer or whatever.
Oh.
And you kind of have like a Collins glass and you'll do a beer for people sometimes. But for some reason in America, we won't really go less than a pint. We have 12-ounce cans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tinnies. And then there used to be little beers called ponies.
Ah, I like that.
But
name.
I still don't. We still don't really see that anymore either. We basically
how big like, are those? Like 7 ounces?
You will have the ponies are about 7 ounces, and then same a as regular can is 12 ounces, and a pint 16 ounces here, unless you want an imperial pint, which is 18 ounces. A proper Guinness glass is 18 ounces.
Wow. So we've pots, schooners, pints. That's pretty much how, if we go to the pub, that's what we're asking for. It's like you get one of those three, pint's the biggest, pot's the smallest.
This is good to know. I want to go back to Australia, and it's good to know that I can order smaller quantities of beer.
And you shouldn't, like, if you come down, order a pony, because they'll
yeah, be you'll get
small, small horse.
Listen, if I order a pony and they give me an actual pony, I'm having the best time in Australia.
I was just gonna say, it sounded like the White Russian joke too, didn't it?
I love a pony and a White Russian. What a night.
okay, so 0.08 over there. So 10 milligrams of pure alcohol in a standard drink. So a standard drink would be a tinny. It would be a nip of alcohol, a nip of whiskey, for example.
A shot.
Or a shot. Or, well, I think a shot. See, a shot in Australia is regulated. A shot over in America, as I found out one of my visits, could be like a pint. Depending on the bartender.
It's really not regulated. I mean, it's generally considered an ounce and a half.
Yeah.
Is considered a shot. But I know for a fact that a typical shot glass can hold 2 ounces. If you go, basically like you can hold a, there's a little line. If you go above the line, it holds an additional half an ounce from the line to the rim. It's like an optical illusion. It seems like it's just a little bit more, and it actually is roughly a quarter of what's left in the glass. And then a lot of popular bars will serve things in rocks glasses, which that's what you're talking about. It can go anywhere from 2 to 3 ounces, 4 ounces.
It's God.
If a guy's just shaking it all up and pouring them across glasses back and forth,
yeah,
you might just fill them up.
So we don't have that here. They're very strict in their, which is about 30 mils. I don't know what that would be in ounces, but I think 30 mils would be one standard drink, and that's what they do.
Okay. And then
because culturally the whole thing is like the bartender is the guy who's like starting the party here. It's not like keeping things regulated and stuff like that. It would be considered to be at a boring bar.
Yeah,
and I remember even
we don't do tips here, right? So your bartender, by giving, you know, you give him a tip, you get more drunk. Alcohol and vice versa. Our bartenders really don't care. They want you out so they can go home.
That's it. Americans love turning anything into an exchange and a currency. Yeah. Like, we like that. We like that with statistics and sports. We like it with whatever. I heard an Australian making fun of Americans because of sick days. Like, why could you have an amount of days that you're allowed to be sick? And it's like, the answer is because we like to turn into a currency. So like, I wasn't sick for 11 days. I'd like to get paid for that. Like, we love, if we can turn something into something that can be traded and bought and increased in value, we love it.
The land of capitalism, right?
It's true.
So that's probably how we break down one standard drink. And so over here, basically,
that's 10 grams of ethanol.
10 grams of ethanol in the drink. So 20 grams, so two standard drinks, would probably get a male of my size, 70 kilos, to 0.05. And we can metabolize one standard drink per hour.
Right.
So
to keep in the legal limit in Australia, you can have two drinks, standard drinks in the first hour, and then a standard drink every hour subsequent to that.
Yes. That's for males predominantly. And then females will metabolize differently because, interestingly.
Careful how you word this, Michael.
Alcohol is very good at being absorbed across tissues, but it doesn't want to get absorbed into fatty tissue. And so fat distribution of an individual matters when it comes to alcohol tolerance and how much alcohol is in the system and how drunk somebody may get. So interestingly, the greater the body fat, the more that alcohol will stay in the blood and will be more likely to get to the brain and have negative effects and increase your blood alcohol reading. So if you were to take two individuals, both 100 kilos, but one was obese, and the other one was a bodybuilder, for example, the bodybuilder would be able to, they would have a lower blood alcohol reading and probably be less drunk, subjectively, compared to the 100 kilo person with a larger body fat
index. Wait a minute. This is news to me.
Yeah.
I always thought just weight was weight, body weight was weight. I didn't know obesity and stuff had to do with this at all.
Alcohol hates fat and will not jump into the fatty tissue. So the more that somebody has,
listen,
as
somebody who worked in an Irish tavern for 8 years, I can tell you that fat does not feel the same way about alcohol. As someone who served cheeseburgers and wings and beer and booze, I'll tell you right now, fat loves alcohol.
That's okay. So let me tell you why. So I'm going to tell you the metabolic process here because, and hopefully I explain this well enough. You tell me if it doesn't make sense. So when you need to metabolize alcohol into acetaldehyde and then into acetyl-CoA, you not just need those enzymes, but you need a molecule that can accept the transfer of energy every time you do this process. And this molecule is called NAD. Now, what happens is when you turn ethanol into acetaldehyde, you also turn NAD into something called NADH. And then when you turn...
Which has just got a hydrogen added to it, right?
Yeah, just added a hydrogen to it. And then when you turn acetaldehyde into acetyl-CoA, so that can be turned into carbon dioxide and water, you turn another molecule of NAD into NADH. So this just keeps happening when you metabolize alcohol. So what effectively happens is your levels of NAD drop because you're using it and your levels of NADH increase because you're producing it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, so when you need to make energy from sugar, like glucose, you actually need the opposite. You need high NAD and low NADH. Now, the same thing happens when you want to turn fat into energy. So anytime you want to burn sugar or burn fat, you need high NAD and low NADH. But when you drink alcohol, it's flipped. So you can't utilize sugar for energy. So your brain effectively thinks it's starving itself when this happens. Now, this is the reason why you want to go out for a kebab at 2 a.m. after drinking, because your brain thinks it's starving. It's going, I've got no sugar, I've got no fats. I need food.
Or buffalo wings.
Or buffalo wings. And you go out and you get it because your brain's going, I'm starving. But here's the problem. You take in the glucose or sugar and you take in the fats and you still can't metabolize it because the seesaw or teeter-totter or whatever it may be is flipped around. And interestingly, when you take in fats to store them, what you need is high NADH and low NAD, which is exactly the environment that you're in from drinking alcohol. So you're more likely to store fats when you drink and less likely to burn sugar and fats. So this is one of the reasons why alcoholics get fatty livers, is because a lot of this is happening in the liver. And so it's not using energy, it's just storing it as fats in that liver. Does that make sense?
It does.
Cool.
I mean, I as someone who's made it this far, I've known for a while that eating after drinking was just not the way to go.
No.
That I definitely noticed weight increase and also never feeling like this is not. And basically, because you also are trying to like sober up, right? And so the whole like eating before you drink thing, I always said like if you're trying to eat after you're already starting to feel buzzed, it's too late.
Yeah,
do
too
not
late.
Take the that path.
That's right. And because you're inebriated, your inhibitions have obviously gone down and you're more likely to ingest more calories as well. So you're not just more hungry.
That's definitely true for me. I know for a fact I did not lower my standard for who I was attracted to, but I did lower my standard for what I found delicious.
What foods you're attracted to.
I was willing to go into places that I would never buy food from sober to be like, this is going to be delicious. This sandwich from this gas station is where it's at.
Yeah. Look at this sushi in this gas station. My God, you look appetizing. I've never seen 10-day-old salmon look so good.
All right, I'm going to quickly just read out a table that has what effects in the body to the different blood alcohol concentrations. And okay. I'll just read the numbers and... Matt, if you want to guesstimate what kind of symptoms you might expect to see.
Okay.
So if you're at 0.02 to 0.04 blood alcohol concentration, what kind of things would you expect to see at this level?
What, like slower reflexes or some kind of like slower motor skill?
Yeah, not yet, apparently. Apparently
for you.
You might start to feel a bit euphoric and your shyness will start to diminish.
There you go, Matt. Your shyness will go. I didn't know you had any, but it's going to disappear.
Maybe that's why I just blazed through that step either way. So, okay, good to know.
All right, moving on. 0.04 to 0.06.
Okay. Speech? Anything with speech?
Still not quite yet. We're getting close to that, though. You are feeling more, you're feeling more relaxed, and you actually feel warm. And this is probably why people used to think having some alcohol keeps you...
ski lodge.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yes. What are the dogs that have the St. Bernards that have the little rum around their neck?
Yeah, a little barrel.
Was that a real thing? Did they actually have that? They had to have, right? They had to have come from something.
It is based in truth. Yeah. I don't think it's still common practice, but it was based in truth. Yeah.
So, relaxation, warmth, and a decrease in inhibitions.
Now they use drones. Drones carry the barrels of alcohol around the ski slope.
All right, so now we go up to 0.1. So this was once Americans' legal limit.
This is once like, hey, that I can still drive, yeah.
All right, let's see. What is it?
What kind of things here do you think?
This has to be motor skill and speech function, right?
Yeah, so speech is going, reaction time's going, balance is going. So
probably good not to drive. Yeah,
definitely keep off the roads there. Now up to between 0.1 and 0.2.
0.1 and 0.2. I'm trying to think because I know... From my days where I was, basically there's times where I lived in New York where there's no way I was near any automobile. And that was probably where I really gave myself full license to really just go for it. And I would say like, that's where I would get like either paranoid or anxious or something like that. Like for example, I would think that the bartender was watering down my drinks on purpose. And then I didn't realize, like, no, buddy, it's that you're so drunk you can't taste that this is alcoholic anymore.
Wow.
And that was, like, really bad news. I imagine that was probably above 0.1 at that point.
I think it sounds like it. Where does paranoia come into play?
Probably almost now. So we go point one to point two, and so the euphoria starts to move to dysphoria, which is you're really starting to feel terrible.
And that's also the term, like, when you know as a bartender to cut someone off, right?
Yeah. Mm.
Someone went from having a good time to all of a sudden being a little chippy about stuff, and you're like, okay, I think the fun's stopping, and why don't you call it a night?
Yeah. Right. Also in Australia, a chippy is a carpenter. So again, probably don't use that term. Because then
that's what I'm talking about. They would start trying to redo the carpet around the bar. And they'd be like, all right, you've clearly had enough.
Get out of here, Chippy.
This carpet was already fantastic.
Which at point two, apparently, this is where you start to get the appearance of a drunk. So that's quite good that you
recognize that you're on the ball.
Yeah.
You're subject.
You're a good bartender.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, point two to point four.
I'll tell you another quick fun story is that as a bartender, I remember I finally got a job bartending in New York. And again, New York City, no one's driving anywhere. So my old instincts for bartending, where I bartended in New Jersey, a suburb where people did drive, I was trying to cut people off. And the managers were like, what are you doing? And I was like, he's got to stop. This is getting bad. And he's like, we're not, no. Wow. He comes in all the time. He'll stop when he wants to stop. And I was like, oh. And I basically got fired for wanting to cut people off at this bar I worked at in the middle of New York.
And you were just being careful about their health.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was just the normal behavior of people from New York. Sober.
Yeah.
Sober.
Well, I guess it turns out like just the operation of an automobile was like the only standard we ever kept as an idea of health for serving people was whether they're going to operate an automobile and that's it.
God.
So.
Yeah,
strange.
I'll tell you what the highest recorded blood alcohol limit is once you finish.
Yeah, we're almost there.
Once you get to
you get to point four, this is where you need assistance to walk. You're completely confused, and your consciousness levels will start to drop. And interestingly, temperature regulation is now diminished. So this is the reason why drinking alcohol to keep warm would be disadvantageous. Moving on to anything above point four now.
What do you think, Matt? Death, maybe?
I mean, I was going to say, what kind of motor skill? I mean, I'm trying to think of something that you have to go to the hospital, get your stomach pumped, right?
Yeah, probably.
I'd say you're right.
We go towards a coma, respiratory arrest, and then to the back end, death. But interestingly, this is kind of the same as a general anesthesia. When you go into a general anesthetic, not only do you get this reaction to vomit, so your stomach wants to throw all its contents up. This is why we don't eat before surgery. But at the same time, you get diminished reflexes, and in this case, it's the gag reflex. And so as the vomit's coming up, you're not going to choke or cough it out, so it goes straight into your lungs, you aspirate and die. And so similar to...
Oh, so when people talk about like they died of vomiting in their sleep,
yeah,
this is what we're
right.
talking about.
Exactly. Yep. And apparently a lot of college students die from this. Well, I'd say a lot, but if they were to die from alcohol poisoning...
It's a number, which is too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said anything above 0.4, it's not good.
Yeah, all for right. a person who's not accustomed to drinking alcohol.
And we'll talk about alcoholics and alcoholism and withdrawal in a second, but the highest recorded blood alcohol reading was a man in Poland who, after a car crash, his blood alcohol reading was 1.48%. So that means he had around about 1.5 grams of pure alcohol in every 100 mils of his blood. Which is,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's 30 times our legal limit in Australia.
Wow.
Which is probably close to 50 standard drinks.
I think, I mean,
how is that even possible?
Like, yeah, I remember, you know, joking with friends where they did like they all got like a case of beer and like they were drink all 24 of these kind of thing for the weekend. Kind of, that's the plan.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine, like, it's crazy to me that as evolved species that have made it this far, that we have the ability to override all of these systems by sheer will to make what you just described happen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like, that's,
well, when you look,
madness.
It is madness. And when you look at alcoholics, so what we've been talking about so far is pretty much somebody who, you know, goes out on the weekend, has drinks, and then maybe Monday to Friday they have probably 1 to 2 drinks a night, right? That's sort of where we're sitting at. But when there's people who drink to excess, whatever that may mean, every night, and they might be termed alcoholics, what you'll find is that their body, particularly their brain, is really good at balancing out the changes that occur. So there's actually neurological, there's anatomical and physiological changes that happen to the brain when somebody drinks. So we've got dozens of neurotransmitters that tell things to excite and tell things to inhibit when we talk about our neurons and so forth. But there's two really important ones, one called GABA, which suppresses everything, and one called glutamate, which activates everything. And when you drink alcohol, it boosts up GABA, so the suppressor.
And that's why it's called a depressant.
Yeah, that's why alcohol's a depressant, and it suppresses glutamate, basically the excitatory transmitter. And so what that means is when you boost up GABA, this is why you get relaxed, this is why you get intoxicated. When you drop down glutamate, this is why you get amnesia and anesthesia associated with drinking alcohol. But if somebody's now in the short term, the acute stage, this is what happens. You have the effects, you stop drinking, and it goes back. The balance of the neurotransmitters go back to relative normality. But if you're drinking long term, you're constantly boosting GABA and constantly suppressing glutamate. And the brain doesn't like this. So it tries to do whatever it can to try and balance it back out again. So what it does is it finds the receptors for each of those. And because GABA, the neurotransmitter, the chemical, is being released at such high numbers, it just drops down how many receptors are being expressed. So that basically, it's like saying you've got 1,000 keys, and instead of having 1,000 doors, we're just going to drop the doors down to 50 doors. So even though you've got heaps of keys, it's only going to open fewer doors. So that's how it drops that GABA down. And it does the same for glutamate. Even though glutamate's low, it increases the amount of doors available for the key, and therefore you're more likely to utilize glutamate. And then it balances itself out. This is what happens with alcoholics. And so this is alcoholism. It's all balanced out while they're drinking. Then when they stop drinking and withdraw, this seesaw of withdrawal occurs. And because now you've downregulated GABA and upregulated glutamate, it flips in the opposite direction. You now have too much glutamate stimulating the brain and not enough GABA. And this is why, and because glutamate's excitatory, this is why when alcoholics withdraw, they have seizures.
Yeah.
Because it's exciting the whole brain. It's going boom, 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 boom. So they have seizures. They've got anxiety.
Heart rate goes up.
Heart rate goes up. All that type of stuff. And so this is why alcoholics, once they withdraw, it's probably likely that when they do it in a safe environment, they may be prescribed things like benzodiazepines because it helps sort of
like
bring that.
Like Valium, which is also an activator of that GABA.
Yeah, so it sort of just brings it back closer to how it was while they were drinking, but without being drunk, for example.
That is crazy, and also what a crazy thing to figure out.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing to figure out how to medicate. I mean, that's just wow.
Yeah, it's insane. So that's why they say for alcoholics, you know, when withdrawing, you know, you need a professional, you do it in a safe environment, you know, all that type of stuff. So, yeah, that's what they're referring to because of the neurotransmitter changes. It can be deadly. Can be deadly for them.
Yeah.
Depending on the individual.
Gents, I might have to wrap it up here on this high note that we just hit.
That's fine. Matty, thank you so much for joining us, Matt. Matt's got to head off. We're going to finish the podcast with ourselves, but it's been such a joy to have you. It's been great. And like I said, I'm fanboying, so I loved having a chat with you, Matty. You're welcome back on our podcast anytime. And
and if you think there's any other disorder that might directly attack me like this one, let's have me back on.
We'll think of the worst diseases we can, and we'll give you a call. Everybody, please.
Obesity next, narcissism, whichever one you're taking next, just let me know. I'll run right over.
So I think everybody should. So everybody needs to download Matt and Manley's Ice Cream Social. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous. It's funny. It's silly. It's just, like I said, it's my favorite comedy podcast. Everybody should be downloading it and listening to it.
And we have a ton of Aussie listeners. We love our Aussie listeners.
You do. You've got a great community, which I'm happy to be a part of. And I've made a number of friends simply through what we call the Hey Scoops community. And it's just good people. And Matt's also a magician. And are you doing Zoom shows? Can people book
I am,
you?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, if you go to aneveningofmagic.com, you can see upcoming Zoom shows that we're doing there. I'll be part of a three magician lineup doing shows over Zoom. Love to have you.
Awesome. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. We'll speak soon.
You got it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, mate.
Bye.
So Matt was great to have on. He was
a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. And look, listeners, I hope you realize
it's good to have a funny man on here for once.
Yeah, that's true. That's so true. And look, we had a comedian on, and I know that some of the content that we're talking about here with alcohol is serious.
Yeah.
But hopefully we can make some of the content lighthearted, and I hope again you realize that we're just trying to make some of the difficult content enjoyable. But please don't think that we're making light of any serious addictions like alcoholism or the fact that people drink and there is serious health consequences associated with that. It is serious, but it is great to have Matt on as a comedian and a magician, and he's just a very comfortable bloke to talk to.
He was lovely. Yeah.
So where should we finish this off, Matty? I think we should...
We've done a lot of the kinetics. So we've done the absorption. We've done the metabolism. The only other thing...
We're talking about hangovers.
We're going into the effect... Oops, I've just moved the cord. Hopefully that's working. We were starting to talk about the effects on the body, right?
Yes.
And we touched upon how the liver becomes fatty, which is steatosis, I think they call it.
Yeah.
Fatty liver. There's other ways that the liver becomes damaged that moves into what we call cirrhosis.
Yeah.
And I think the intermediate phase between a fatty liver, because this is where the doctors would say if they have suspicion that you had a fatty liver, which would be possibly through maybe not processing sugars well, as in like you might have problems with regulating blood sugar, but also your liver enzymes might be disordered or out of range.
Because you can have alcohol-based fatty liver disease, and you can have non-alcoholic.
Yep. And so they would want to try to investigate what the cause of it is. Now, if it's not rectified, it will then move into like a hepatitis form, which is based on an alcohol induced hepatitis. Hepatitis
inflammation.
Is inflammation. Yeah. Now, some of the ways that happens was, as you specified, with the NADH being in excess. There's also the byproducts of metabolizing the ethanol in the liver causes the formation of adducts, which is kind of other macromolecules and enzymes that can join the byproduct, which then kind of causes a hypersensitivity in the liver, like an inflammation.
Yeah.
Brings in the immune system, and that causes inflammation.
Yep.
But another interesting thing was that chronic exposure to ethanol in the bowel, as we know, in the bowel, particularly the large bowel, we have a lot of bacteria, and there is the gram-negative bacteria, which have intrinsically in their membrane a lipopolysaccharide.
Part of the cell wall, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's the membrane, not the wall, but I could be wrong.
Probably.
What happens is when these bacteria are destroyed, they release this endotoxin, okay, which becomes highly reactive in our body and can elicit a serious immune response.
So lipopolysaccharide, also known as LPS, that's an endotoxin.
Yes, that's right. Okay, it's intrinsic to the bacteria itself, whereas an exotoxin, the bacteria secretes it outwards.
Gotcha, okay. So alcohol will release
chronically,
this LPS.
Chronically.
And so that is a pro-inflammatory chemical.
So the LPS then gets absorbed in your bowel, into your blood. And as we know, any blood that's absorbed across your intestines, the first stop is your liver. So your liver then starts to get bombarded with LPS, and that causes further
inflammation. Can I tell you what can further damage the liver in this process? So particularly with alcoholics, so while I said, you know, there's that pathway of metabolism, ethanol, acetaldehyde, off to acetyl-CoA and then carbon dioxide and water, using those enzymes, alcohol dehydrogenase and acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, there's another pathway that we can use to metabolize alcohol. And this is, alcoholics probably use this one primarily. And this is the CYP, or the cytochrome P450 family pathway.
Okay.
And what CYPs do is they're part of what we call the xenobiotic metabolism. they're part of a detoxification pathway that the body has. And they detoxify anything that might be a threat to the body. So it could be alcohol, it could be other drugs, it could be things we ingest, whatever that may be. So what can happen with alcoholics is they use this sip, and what it does is it turns ethanol again into acetaldehyde, but in the process it produces a whole bunch of reactive oxygen species.
Can you give me an example of one?
Like hydrogen peroxide.
Yeah, I was going to say you used it to bleach your hair once.
Hydroxyl ion, an oxide ion. Yeah. So
superoxide.
So they're basically just oxygen-based molecules that are reactive and unstable.
Yeah.
And so what they'll do is they'll travel around the body trying to find electrons and things to normalize them.
Yep.
And that's why they're damaging. Okay. So the point I'm making is that you produce a whole bunch of these reactive oxygen species, particularly alcoholics, in the liver when you're metabolizing, because you have to hijack another pathway to metabolize all the alcohol or ethanol that you're ingesting.
So now your liver is in a state of inflammation. And as we know, with chronic inflammation, the body tries to heal it. And one way of it doing that is laying down collagen. But also you activate a cell in the liver, I think called a stellate cell, which is a connective tissue cell, opposed to a Kupffer cell, which is a macrophage, which is probably part of the inflammatory phase of it. Mm. But then we move into a chronic connective tissue phase, which you start laying down collagen in place of hepatocytes.
So scar tissue.
Scar tissue. So your
so you're saying
liver starts to become cobblestoned with collagen.
So it starts with fatty deposition, starts with the fatty liver, and then the fatty liver moves off to an inflamed liver, which then moves off to a scarred liver.
Yeah, and so in Latin, I think a cobbled liver is cirrhosis.
Gotcha.
And then it's liver failure.
Wow.
We could do literally multiple podcasts on the function of the liver.
Yeah.
But now you lose that function.
We've done one podcast on the liver.
And so, no, I just mean like the extent of all the things.
Oh, absolutely right. Absolutely.
And so you'll start to see everything that liver does, you'll start to see dysfunctions in that space, like going yellow, not being able to control fluid balance, bleeding, coagulopathies, etc.
Wow.
So that's, is there anything else? And then I guess we've kind of spoke about the brain.
Yeah, spoken about the brain effects. We've spoken about how alcohol alters our metabolism. It was spoken about the direct effects on neurotransmitters. We've spoken about the effects that it has on inflammation at the stomach and the changes, other changes in metabolism, gut flora. We've spoken about just then the direct damage to the liver. Now let's talk about what may happen to somebody the day after they drink.
Oh, a hangover.
And talk about a hangover. So it would have been good to ask Matt whether he...
Because a hangover was in Las Vegas.
Oh, that's a good point. And it would have been good to know whether... worst hangover, so that we could go through the symptoms. Not because, again, we condone it, but to know what the symptoms are, and we can talk about that. But also whether he has any, you know, home remedies, any cures, so that we can dispel all of them. Yeah. Because basically none of them work. But when somebody gets a hangover, you know, next day, they feel pretty horrid, tired, potentially anxious, a bit depressed, dehydrated.
Nauseous.
Nauseous.
Vomiting.
Yeah, potentially vomiting, bit of reflux, a bit foggy. All of these are
symptoms. Drug bogs.
What's that?
I don't drink, so...
But you know the term.
But back in my day when I did drink, I think it's
after grog bogs.
Or whether it's to do with the consistency or the smell, I'm not sure.
Look.
I wonder if that's probably more to do with the food that you consumed.
It could be. Could be the food you consumed, you overconsumed, and also the direct effects of inflammation that the alcohol can have in the intestines and the damage to the gut flora.
Mm.
So probably a culmination of all those. So let's talk about what causes the hangover. We don't really know. That's the first thing we should say. But
it's good assumptions.
The good assumptions that it's a multitude of things.
Yeah.
One, it's the acetaldehyde that the ethanol...
It's just a direct irritant.
Acetaldehyde is not a great thing, particularly in the quantity that you produce from drinking alcohol.
Okay.
It does damage tissues. It can lead to inflammation like we've spoken about. Anything that causes inflammation is going to make you feel not too great.
One thing we did forget to mention with the an effect that the alcohol has on the brain is it has an effect in the hypothalamus pituitary gland
to impact
the release of ADH.
Well, let me talk about that last as breaking the seal because I want to talk about the myth of breaking
the
seal.
In terms of this is part of the reason why you're dehydrated.
Go on. Yep.
Well, from my readings, usually ADH is just a way of preserving water in our body and usually that would be switched on. But
did you say it's antidiuretic hormone? Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Antidiuretic hormone.
Yeah.
Because
you said ADH earlier alcohol dehydrogenase.
A different one, yeah. So this particular molecule, which releases from the pituitary gland, tries to conserve water, right, normally. But if you block it with alcohol, it doesn't produce this, so you expel excessive amounts of water out of the kidney. So this is why you probably urinate a lot.
Yeah.
Now, my understanding is the quantity of the water that you expel from your bladder is about three times the amount of whatever you ingested. So I guess if you had a can, you would, which is how much?
About 385 mils, I think.
You would urinate out about a litre.
285 mils, sorry.
About a litre of fluid would come out of your kidneys.
Only within the first 2 hours.
Okay. I think this is where the term breaking the seal.
Yeah, I might as well talk about it now. So people think that you go to the pub, have a few drinks with some friends, and you say, "Oh, if I go to the bathroom and do a wee now, I'm just going to be weeing all night. You know, I don't want to break the seal." But what actually happens is there is in a way, a seal to break because, like you said, you drink X amount of alcohol, and the alcohol will inhibit antidiuretic hormone at the posterior pituitary. And like you said, antidiuretic stops you from peeing, so you're inhibiting.
The diuretic is a peer.
Yeah, you're inhibiting the inhibitor. So you're promoting peeing. And because they found out in the 60s and 70s that alcohol resulted in more urine being produced and more dilute urine being produced. And so what they also found was that this effect happened within the first 60 minutes of drinking alcohol and waned after 90 minutes and then the levels of ADH went back up to normal.
Oh.
Even if they kept drinking, it went back up to normal through the rest of the drinking period. So you basically will excrete large amounts of dilute urine within the first 2 hours. And then after that, you're just going to excrete as much urine as you would normally from drinking that much fluid.
Because there is a lot of, particularly with beer, there is a lot of water in it.
Yeah, about, do you drink a full bottle of water every hour? Like somebody at the pub? Yeah, I probably do. But like somebody at the pub would probably do that.
Yeah.
Right? So of course you're going to urinate more.
By pure water volume as well.
But if you don't, but because of the early stages of you urinating far more liquid than you ingested, you're setting yourself up to be in a state of dehydration.
Yeah.
And which is one of the main causes of
a hangover.
That's so right.
That was the point that I was getting to.
Oh, you're smart. You set
long
it
way,
up.
A long way around.
No, very good.
And the headache is probably from the brain shrinking.
The brain shrinking?
Yeah, well.
Can yours get any smaller? That's the question we've all been asking.
The brain itself doesn't have pain receptors.
All right.
But its covering does, which is the meninges. And some of the meninges is stuck.
So your brain doesn't feel pain, it just interprets it.
That's right, exactly.
Wow.
You're deep.
Thanks.
Now, the brain is wrapped up in a glad wrap covering, which we call the meninges. Some of that meninges is stuck to the skull, okay?
Yep.
And some of it is
It's called the dura mater.
Yeah, and some of it's attached to the brain itself.
It's called the pia mater.
And so hopefully that they're in a nice close contact. But if the brain shrinks slightly because of the hydration status, it pulls apart from each other and there's a lot of pain receptors in there and that would give you that really kind of dull throbbing.
Interesting.
Possibly also with the dilatation status of your blood vessels around in your brain at the time as well. And that's why you get throbbing kind of hangover headaches.
Okay, so dehydration definitely. Probably a change in ion levels. One because you're directly changing neurotransmitters, which effectively relies on ions, and you're urinating out a lot more and particularly a lot more dilute urine. So that's going to change ion levels as well. So that changes a whole bunch of stuff within the body. We spoke about the acetaldehyde. That's just quite a nasty thing.
There's one big one.
All right, let's say we've changed the bacteria. We've promoted inflammation. What have I missed?
It's the type of alcohol that you consumed. So there is something called congeners, and you did talk to Matt about that.
Yep.
So apparently certain beverages that have a darker colour to it have a greater quantity of congeners,
And these are just byproducts of the fermentation process.
That's right.
All right.
And so when alcohol, some alcohol is distilled, you remove these, potentially you lose some of these congeners. So I think as you distill, I'm not saying this is 100% correct, but the distillation of some would maybe make it a more of a cleared,
So the distillation process to produce vodka, which is a very clear fluid, I would assume would be a greater distillation process than for rum, which is a dark rum, for example. I mean, it's a different distillation process.
Or red wine. Mm. Which is probably not distilled at all.
And so the congeners there just have what varying effects. So these are things like acetone, methanol, acetaldehyde is a congener actually, because it's part of the process. They're just chemicals that can wreak havoc in a multitude of ways.
Yeah, and interestingly, when we humans developed the process of distillation, can you, in 20 seconds, just explain how that would have been done?
Distillation?
Yeah.
Well, you need to ferment, so you use the yeast with sugar, no oxygen.
So we've got, let's just say ethanol. We've got something like wine. We've got wine, which is natural.
All right, so you
how
produce...
How do we then distill it?
Well, I would have to say this is a guess. You'd have to heat to a varying degree, because when you heat something up, everything's got a different evaporation point.
Excellent.
And I know that alcohol has a lower evaporation point than water.
Or ethanol
compared to other components. So I'd assume that everything would evaporate off at a different temperature. And so you could use varying tubes to take different things at different temperatures.
Exactly.
And therefore you can isolate.
And these are called heads. Like as you remove stuff off, it's calling removing the heads.
So I'm right.
You're right.
Oh.
So it's basically, it shoots off a bulb, like where all the fluid is, up to a tube.
And that's
as
called,
all the gas is going
the head.
Up. As the gas is going up,
yep.
then all that evaporated gas will then turn back into a fluid because it's cooled back down. And then that is the distillation product.
Okay.
And because when they first kind of discovered this, they termed this spirits.
Because it's
the spirit of the alcohol.
Oh,
and so they.
The body, the life, the life of it, the life force.
And so this was significantly stronger than the whole fermented product with the congeners and everything else in it.
Interesting.
And so this is initially.
So did they just add back congeners then? Because congeners would be.
I think they add then flavors and then where they.
Depending on how strict they are with the age
and so forth.
Yeah.
And this is, I think initially. The spirits were used more medicinally and then humans then used obviously as a drink and beverage.
Interesting. I like that.
Mm. Oh, sorry, it's a bit of a tangent.
No.
I was going to say it earlier, but I just...
No, that's good. And I think we've covered hangover. Are there any cures for it? There's one cure.
Not drinking.
Yeah, just don't drink. Just don't drink. And I think it's probably a good place to end here is by saying that, like I mentioned earlier, there is not one safe, there is no safe quantity of alcohol to consume.
That's recommended by science.
Correct. I mean, there are government recommendations on how many standard drinks somebody should or could consume, and it's more than one, right? Which I think is strange because when you look at ill health effects, one or more is going to promote ill health effects. We know this. Like I said, the 2018 Lancet paper just demonstrated this. So... While we have been lighthearted, hopefully we've made you laugh a little bit and made you think at the same time. Hopefully you don't think that we are belittling anybody or anyone. And I hope you don't think that we are trivializing a complex and difficult topic either, because we know that it is serious. So, but we do hope that we did make you smile. Matt was great, I think.
Thank you.
I should have been specific. And... we really hope that you listen to our next podcast, which is on something I don't even know. What are we doing? Do we know? No?
Is this a time where you might mention that we are doing like a side podcast?
Oh, good. We haven't released it yet.
But I think it's good advertising.
All right. Well, look, if you've made it to an hour and 38 minutes then or whatever it is.
Let me just say, of those 138, it's only 28 minutes of just you and I. So at least we can blame Matt for this.
True. I suppose that's what happens when you're a comedian, you go off track. But we are making a side podcast, and this side podcast is a lot shorter. So it's good that we're mentioning the time frame here. So It's basically about the weird and wonderful things that our body does. So we go through things like farts and burps and hiccups and things like that. And we
yawning,
and we talk about it in a way that hopefully is enjoyable.
We've a different format.
Yeah,
it's we have a slightly different format.
Yeah, so the format is one of us comes in and actually doesn't even know what the topic is, and the other person's the only one who's prepared. So we have three segments within our new podcast. The segment's called Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Minutes, because it only goes for around about 20 to 30 minutes. The first part is called Off the Cuff. Off the Cuff is where the person who hasn't prepared has to say everything that they know about that topic, right? Goes for 1 minute. Boom. This is what I know. And then the next part is called Teach You a Lesson. And this is where the person who's prepared talk about that topic. And they tell us, they teach the other person a lesson. The other person asks questions. And then the last part is called Pop Quiz, or Pop Pop Wants a Treat. And this is where the person who doesn't know the topic gets quizzed on what they've just learned. So it's a good educational resource and it's a lot of fun.
Where do I find this, Michael?
Well, I haven't uploaded it yet, but it's going to be on all good podcasts.
So you won't find it anywhere unless you have hacked Michael's computer.
Yes, don't hack my computer, please. And it's going to be on YouTube as well, because we film all the video.
Okay.
I think we've filmed all the video for them. But I will let you know. You can contact me on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Mike Todorovic, at DrMiketodorovic. And it's the same handle at Twitter if you want to come have a chat with me. Otherwise, you can send us an email, gubiosciences@gmail.com. That's gubiosciences@gmail.com. If you sent us an email and I haven't responded to you, I'm sorry. We do get a lot of emails, but send us another email to remind me. Please give us a 5-star rating on
iTunes.
I don't know if you can give us a rating on Spotify, but do something that spreads the good word. If you don't think we're worth 5 stars, don't worry about doing it. Don't give us any less than 5. It's not good for us. But apart from that, thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.